To top it all off, the other girl in the car was 15-year-old Trisha Faulkner, whose entire family was rotten to the core. Most of the men had been in and out of prison, and the women were always offering explanations for bruises and worse. Trisha was known for being deeply troubled, acting out with drugs and sex at a shockingly young age. Sensible people kept their distance, but apparently Angela wasn't being sensible. Ginny remembered listening from the bedroom door when Danny went into Angela's room to ask her what she was doing in a car with a grown man. Angela had broken down in tears, apologizing for her mistake, but then tried to explain what drew her to people like that, summer people. She said that for 9 months a year, she looked around and saw nothing to be hopeful about. Everyone she knew worked all day, every day, and nothing ever changed. But once the season started, people showed up who had more than jobs. They had careers and plans and traveled the world, a world she wanted to be a part of. She said that people like the BMW driver made her feel special. Ginny was prepared to comfort Danny when he joined her alone in the kitchen afterward. She wanted to assure him that he was a good man and a good provider, and that Angela was going through a phase after suddenly blossoming into a beautiful girl who looked older than her 14 years. She had expected her husband to blame himself for not giving Angela a better life. Instead, he had slumped into his chair and glared at Angela's door. "I never thought I'd say this, but I'm ashamed of our daughter." He forbade Angela from talking to Trisha Faulkner, which only seemed to draw them closer in the weeks and months that followed. Ginny knew Angela, didn't tell her everything, but she still confided in her enough for Ginny to know that there was something honorable in Angela's devotion to her friend. Angela said Trisha didn't have anyone who cared about her, including her own family, and was counting down the days until she was 18 so she could leave home. She hinted that something bad was happening to Trisha, but that her mother didn't believe her, and she was afraid to talk to the police. Angela didn't fill in the details, but she seemed to be confirming what many people already wondered about the men in that family. What Danny and Ginny saw as reckless, Angela seemed to view as a search for better options. These two girls were determined to get out of the East End and were trying to absorb every bit of knowledge they could from people they thought were better and wiser simply by virtue of their resources. The car crash incident wasn't the last of the curfew violations that summer or for the next 2 years. They tried grounding her, but short of installing locks on her door, they couldn't keep her from walking out. Ginny would tell herself that at least Angela came home every night. Trisha, meanwhile, would disappear for days or weeks at a time, suddenly turn back up in town, and the trouble with Angela would start again. And then, on July 17th, 2 summers later, when Angela was 16 years old, she disappeared. 3 years after, the police killed the man who'd taken her, and Angela came home with Spencer. She was finally safe. She got her GED, she started working, she had a good business started, and then Jason came along. Jason wasn't a coked-up banker. He wasn't that monster who offered Angela a ride home from a beach party she was too young to be at. But something about him was grandiose, his goodness a bit too on display. Like every part of his life was about cultivating an identity. He couldn't just be normal. And most importantly to Ginny, he was an outsider. And so when he first appeared in Angela's life, Ginny couldn't help but think about the 14-year-old Angela, sitting on her bed and telling her father that the lives of the Mullen family weren't good enough for her, and that she, in some small way, even at that young age, saw her looks as a way to achieve something better. Despite Ginny's worries, though, Jason had turned out to be a far better man than she ever expected. He wasn't simply toying with a beautiful local beneath his station. He actually followed through. He married Angela. He was raising Spencer. And though Ginny knew that Angela would have preferred that Jason never leave the walls of the ivory tower, Ginny also suspected that he would have already declared a run for office if it hadn't been for Angela's misgivings. But this new allegation was far worse than the initial one. The last time Ginny spoke to Angela, Jason had been thrilled with the good news that the intern was getting trashed in the media. Ginny could hear the mixed feelings in Angela's voice over the phone. If it were any other case, Ginny would be the one writing a letter to the East Hampton Star to deplore the blaming of the victim. Angela's whole life revolved around Jason, and so of course she was choosing his side. But Ginny believed that some part of Angela actually felt for that intern. She, of all people, knew what it was like for people to believe you can't really be a victim if you're that kind of girl. Her thoughts were interrupted by a knock at the door. She peered through the pebbled arch of glass in the wood to see a blurry figure. The logic behind the design of this door had escaped her for the past 33 years, but she didn't care enough about it to change it. Once she opened the door, she recognized her visitor as Detective Stephen Hendricks. His gray beard was a little bushier than the last time she'd seen him, and his hairline had receded a tad farther, but he still had those damn glasses hanging from a cord around his neck. Danny always said the man was trying to look cerebral. She didn't invite him in. "Please hear me out." He had called her twice in the last week. She had deleted both messages. She stepped aside so he could enter. The house suddenly felt smaller and in even more need of the TLC that Angela kept offering to pay for. Ginny immediately remembered the way Hendricks had scanned their home 15 years earlier when Angela first went missing. She could feel him judging them, like he already knew the full story from the look of their house and a 2-year-old police report from a single car accident with Tricia Faulkner and their daughter in the car.
"What do you know about the accusations against your son-in-law?" Hendricks asked.
"Not sure why that's your business." Other than passing him a couple times at the grocery store, Ginny's last contact with Hendricks had been a note he'd written almost a decade ago, stuck in their screen door. He said that the biggest mistake he had ever made as a police officer was not trying harder to find their daughter. The note had ended with, "All I can say is that I'm sorry." Ginny had never shown the note to Danny. Danny was dealing with enough guilt of his own. She always wondered if it contributed to the stroke that killed him 5 years ago.
"Even an old guy like me can reach out when necessary."
"Reach out to who, Jason? Doubt he's in a mood to talk to police right now."
"No, I meant to the NYPD. Let them know there's another side to the story. Assuming there is, of course. Police get a gut feel on a case and fill in the blanks from there. If they think Jason looks wrong for this, I can present his version, be his advocate, so to speak."
Ginny resisted the urge to remind him that he had formed a gut instinct about Angela when she first disappeared, and then filled in the blanks as he saw fit. The car crash, a stop on the beach for a minor in possession of alcohol, the friendship with Tricia, who ran away the way other girls changed lipsticks. Ginny had made so many visits to the police station that the staff started heading for the bathroom when they saw her walking toward the entrance. When Tricia left town for good shortly after her 18th birthday, it seemed to validate Hendricks's version of the facts. Angela had run away for a life somewhere away from Springs, and then her fucked-up BFF Tricia followed suit as soon as she was legal.
"Why are you offering?" Ginny asked.
"You know why.
When I got the phone call from Pittsburgh PD saying that one of the girls in that house was Angela, well, I felt my heart stop. I still can't sleep some nights knowing what she was going through. And the way I ignored all your worries. I know Danny died without ever forgiving me. He blamed the animal who took her. And he blamed the Faulkner family for getting her involved in trouble.
He didn't blame you," she said. Everything she said was true. She didn't add that Danny also blamed himself.
"Anyone ever hear from Tricia again?"
Ginny had spent 3 years playing a bizarre game of whack-a-mole, chasing down every oddball rumor that popped up as to Angela's whereabouts. She joined a cult of aspiring yoga fiends. Ginny found the cult, but no sign of her daughter. She met a rich older man and moved to a state where it was legal to get married without parental consent. Turned out there was no such state. When Tricia disappeared, the word in town was that she had gone down to Rincon to join her friend, Angela. Ginny had spent half their savings account on flying a private investigator all the way down to Puerto Rico. Nothing.
"Not that I know of. I like to think that maybe as much as she was a bad influence on Angela, Angela was a good influence on her. She always told Angela all she wanted to do was get away from her family as soon as she was 18, so maybe she's got a nice life. And I thought Angela had a nice life, too, once I heard she got married and moved to the city. It gave me some peace about my role and all of what happened. But now this. I mean, let's say hypothetically that the NYPD reaches out to me about Angela. What do you want me to say? I know you're touchy about her privacy, but I could vouch for her husband and say he's a good man. I don't know, Steve. I'm not sure how Angela's going to react to that. Ask her, okay? It helps to have a cop in your corner, even if it's a dumb guy like me."
Ginny was surprised when Angela picked up on the second ring.
"Hi, Mom."
Normally, her daughter tried to hide her annoyance at being disrupted. Ginny didn't take it personally. She knew that Angela hated the slightest bit of surprise. Her routine made her feel safe. But on this day, her daughter actually sounded happy to hear from her.
"Are you okay, Jelly?"
"Trying to be."
Her 31-year-old daughter, already mother to a 13-year-old, sounded so tired. Ginny told Angela about the visit from Steve Hendricks and his offer to act as a kind of advocate for Jason to the NYPD. I can't believe you let that guy in the house. I think he really does blame himself for not finding you sooner. Finding me? He couldn't bother to look for me. Why are you defending him? Angela knew that not only Hendricks, but most of the town had assumed that she ran away when she went missing. She had also learned how many people had come to pity Ginny for insisting that someone had kidnapped her daughter. But to this day, Angela had no idea that Danny had essentially given the town permission to feel that way. He was convinced Angela had left them. He even apologized to Hendricks for Ginny's pestering. I'm not defending him, Ginny said, but he's offering to help, and maybe you need it. I'm simply relaying the message. Too little, too late, Angela said. He tried calling me last week, and I hung up on him. Felt kind of good, actually. You're right, Ginny said, deciding to drop the matter for now. Fuck that guy. I learned that from your son, by the way. Kid cusses worse than I do. 26. Memo. To Powell File from Olivia Randall. R.E. Client Interview Notes. Date, May 26th. Long interview and mock cross of client yesterday. Full audio saved digitally. Highlights and takeaways. Client says Lynch was initiator. Kissed him after walking him to car after dinner, Morton's, on Long Island. Stopped, said she'd had too much wine, and why are the good ones always married? First sexual encounter was 2 weeks later at her house after she asked him over for a drink after end-of-day meeting at company 8 months ago. 3 months ago, client became aware of irregularities at business, Oasis Inc. Unexplained payments not aligned with work performed on site. He disclosed concerns to Lynch. She hinted that company engaged in kickbacks and doctored financial statements to cover up. She led him to believe she was looking for proof internally, but he never saw evidence. Lynch began asking client to leave wife about 4 months ago. He never promised, but didn't say no either. Said he stayed for son, no formal adoption, therefore client has no parental rights if divorce his wife. Says he felt trapped. Didn't want to lose Lynch, didn't want to leave family, plus stress of needing her to help prove concerns against company so he could extract himself professionally with clean hands. No emails, texts, phone messages to confirm ongoing affair. Per him, Lynch was caught in year-long affair with CEO of Oasis, Tom Fisher. Fisher's wife was suspicious and read texts. Lynch was humiliated. Almost fired, except she threatened to sue. Was still on outs with company. Per client, Lynch, paranoid that company was looking for dirt on her, would fire her if they knew of affair with consultant. That's why no texts, etc. He told no one of affair. Colleague Zach Hawkins noticed Lynch would be in client's office with him alone, once tried to walk in and found door locked. Client was defensive, arrogant, uncross, try to keep him off stand unless substantial improvement in future mocks. Denies grabbing Rachel Sutton, see above, RE defensiveness. Doesn't recall exact words, but said something like she needed to live a little before she locked that down. He was changing clothes at time, admitted it was possible he prolonged the process to get a rise out of Rachel, whom he found cloying and immature. Other women may come forward. Prior infidelities during marriage, out-of-town hookups, Tinder, one-night stands, etc. But per client, Lynch was only ongoing affair. I thought I loved her. I can't believe she's doing this to me. The client believes it's possible Lynch getting financial benefit from Oasis slash Fisher in exchange for undermining him, but also thinks she is angry at him for feet dragging on leaving the wife. 27. 4 days later. I almost took a U-turn on the Sawmill Parkway, literally, as in the middle of the highway. Listening to Spencer singing along to my playlist of early aughts hip-hop, LL Cool J, Ludacris, Mary J. Blige, I realized how much I was going to miss him. There was a break in the metal barrier in the middle of the highway, those spots where the police wait for speed traps. I eyed it, thinking how easy it would be to just go back home. But then I remembered how hard I had worked that morning to keep him busy. Eat your breakfast, don't forget the sunscreen, how many pairs of underwear did you pack? In the hope that he wouldn't have time to go online and see any possible breaking news about Jason's case. Olivia had called the night before to report that the moment Jason had warned me to expect was official. She had a source in the crime lab. The DNA on that woman's clothing matched Jason's. Of course it did. He had admitted to sleeping with her only days before the swab was taken. Every day felt like a new hammer dropped, but the pounding wasn't going to stop. The DNA results would hit the news. Jason would be arrested. He would be charged. There would be a trial, then a result. One way or the other. So I kept driving, hoping that somehow our world would feel normal again by the time camp was over. Jason was on the phone in the kitchen when I made it back. He told whoever it was to hold on for a second and then walked over and hugged me. I let myself be held, knowing I should hate him more, but missing our son. Jason had wanted to come with us. I told him that I wanted Spencer to myself for the morning, but the truth was that Spencer didn't want Jason to go. He knew it was his father's fault he was being sent away. Jason went back to his call, and I walked upstairs to our bedroom and closed the door. I looked at the Lisa Unger novel lying open on my nightstand. Susanna had given me one of her books more than a year ago, swearing I would love it. I never got around to reading it until I needed something to distract me from my actual life. Now I was on my third one. But instead of picking up the book the way I should have, I reached for my laptop. I pulled up the login page to NYU's email system and typed in Jason's email address, followed by his password. He didn't know I had it, or at least I didn't think so. I only knew it because he had been the one to get cable installed after we moved into the carriage house. I had called him at work to ask the password to upgrade our internet speed after Spencer complained that we were living like cavemen. Gretchen 83. Even then, I must have already been jealous, because I had immediately asked him who Gretchen was. Turns out it was his grandmother. And 83 was August 3rd, our wedding anniversary. Now, I typed that number to finalize my invasion into his privacy. I had already read every message between him and that woman. Between him and anyone at Oasis. I searched for messages from Rachel, but found nothing. I opened random messages simply because they were to or from another woman. Since he'd confessed to the affair, snooping on my husband's emails had become part of my daily ritual. I heard footsteps on the stairs and quickly marked the open message from someone named Melanie Upton, who apparently was the senior associate director of human resources at NYU, sending her number to Jason so they could discuss his question about his retirement account directly, as unread. I was closing my laptop when Jason walked in.
So that was Olivia. She met with the DA who's handling the case.
I prepared myself for the blow. Are they going to let you turn yourself in, or do I have to keep sitting here day in and day out, wondering when they're going to barge in with handcuffs?
You think you're the one in limbo? How do you think I feel, Angela? My colleagues and students are calling me a rapist. Meanwhile, I keep showing up at school so the university doesn't have an excuse to stop paying me and revoke my tenure. Zach is going to have to cover the podcast for now so we don't lose advertisers, but that's a temporary fix. Clients are calling, asking what's going on. I'm numb, and I'm terrified.
I didn't bother reminding him that NYU had asked him to take a leave of absence, with pay, for the sake of reducing the disruption on campus. Jason's response had been to threaten to sue if they made any changes to his status when he hadn't even been charged with a crime, let alone convicted. He continued to insist that the only way to show he was innocent was to pretend as if everything were normal. Who was I to argue? I had spent the last 12 years putting one foot in front of another to prove that what happened in the past didn't matter. Well, forgive me that I no longer have the luxury of doing what I do every day, which is to take care of our son and this family. Instead, I had to hide Spencer away at some bullshit hippie camp for rich kids just so he wouldn't be on the internet reading the details of your secret life outside this house. So don't say this isn't about me. Now, are you gonna tell me what the DA said or not?
Olivia laid out Carrie's motive to lie.
I hated hearing that woman's name come out of his mouth.
She said the ADA looked pretty overwhelmed when she started getting into the details of the problems at Oasis. My guess is the guy can't find the countries we're talking about on a map. She told us not to get our hopes up, though.
Oh, I don't think I need that warning. He was tentative as he sat on the bed next to me, as if he were seeking permission.
You can bail if you want. I haven't asked you to stay.
I shook my head.
And I really am sorry about Spencer going to camp.
I know. I could feel myself starting to cry.
You're scared for yourself, too, aren't you?
I nodded. Everything was falling apart. Ever since his agent told him that his book was going to be number one on the bestseller list, I had this terrible feeling that nothing would be the same again. All I wanted was to be Angela Powell, wife and mother, with my rules and routines and rituals,
good and boring. If I could have one wish, I would erase the entire world's knowledge of my existence before I reappeared in East Hampton with Spencer. Every time the phone rings, I'm convinced it's gonna be someone asking me about him. My shoulders were shaking between sobs. I didn't need to tell Jason that the him was Charlie. I let him hold my hand. That's not gonna happen. And even if it did, would that be so bad? I hate to say it, but this could wind up being a blessing in disguise. If for you, obviously, not me. If it all came out, you'd be free. That cloud over your whole life would be gone. If this were the first time we'd had this conversation, it might have felt like he really did want what was best for me. But Jason had always known about Susanna's open invitation to help me go public, as she called it, and had never questioned my rejection of it until he himself became a public figure. He talked about the cloud over my life, but it had become a cloud over his, too. And maybe the freedom he cared about now was his and not mine. When I didn't respond, he knew to pivot the conversation again. Oh, and Olivia wanted to talk to you. I told her you'd give her a call when you have a chance. I mean, if that's okay.
I nodded. Yeah, I'll call her in a bit. I just want to chill out for a while after that drive.
No problem. I was about to order some wine from Master Place. Any requests?
I shook my head. As far as I was concerned, there were only two kinds, red and white, and I'd drink either with anything. By the way, did you call the dealer yet? I asked.
Jesus, Angela, seriously?
What? That wobble on the front end's still there, and it's still under warranty. The last time he drove it, he said he could barely tell what I was talking about. I should have known that he wouldn't make the service appointment.
Excuse me for not keeping up with your to-do list during all this.
You want your wife and son to get in a car accident because you're too busy dealing with your mistress to make a phone call? I knew I was being a bitch, but one of the rules when we bought that car was that he'd be the one to oversee the maintenance. One of our other splurges when Jason started making outside money was to upgrade our wagon from the Subaru to an Audi. The only improvement I cared about was the built-in GPS and satellite radio. I had no interest in taking care of a fancy German car with all the other bells and whistles. His voice softened.
Fine, I'll call the dealer.
And can you ask them to install a GPS update while they're at it? I was almost daring him to say something. How many times had he told me to use my phone like everyone else? Both he and Spencer teased me mercilessly for my airplane mode in the car rule. It's called airplane mode, not car mode, Mom. I didn't care what everyone else did. I'd read an article 2 years earlier about people who crashed when their phones rang unexpectedly. I wasn't going to risk Spencer's life because I couldn't go offline for a little while. I knew the two of them cheated by silencing their phones instead, but the rule stood. Once again, he pretended to defer to me.
No problem, he said. And please let me know once you've talked to Olivia. I appreciate you doing that.
He was about to leave the room when I stopped him. You didn't tell her, did you? About me? I had seen what she'd done to Rachel to help her client. There was no hesitation in his reply.
Of course not.
I didn't believe him.
28. Brian King was wrestling a dumpling between chopsticks when Corinne knocked on his open office door.
You can use a fork, you know. The Chinese people will forgive you.
It seems wrong somehow. I once stopped seeing a woman because she ordered a banana daiquiri at a wine bar.
Good riddance to her. I've got something for you. She dropped the DNA results on his desk.
The DNA on Carrie Lynch's skirt and panties was Powell's.
We were expecting it, but now it's official.
Hate to break it to you, but I already got the heads up. Is it bad that I was kind of hoping it would be a bust?
He nudged the takeout container in her direction, and she plucked a dumpling with her fingers.
I know you've got a losing streak right now.
The office has a losing streak, he continued.
Fine, whatever. But this case is winnable.
Except he's got one of the best defense attorneys in the city.
Not surprisingly, she called me within half an hour of my getting the results asking for a meeting. She's got a way of nabbing inside information.
I think half of law enforcement is secretly in love with her.
If she were a man, you'd admire his vast network of contacts.
If she were a man, I wouldn't have asked her out 2 years ago only to get shut down.
She was in here this morning giving me a preview of what we're looking at if we go to trial. They're claiming consent, and not just the one time. According to Powell,
He and Carrie have been having an affair since last October.
Bullshit.
Why didn't he say something the first time I asked about her?
Because you showed up at his house while his wife and kid were within earshot, and he didn't think it was relevant.
They'll argue you misled him into thinking you were still investigating Rachel Sutton's complaint, so he didn't see the harm of lying about a completely consensual extramarital dalliance.
We did mislead him. That's what you told me to do.
Yeah, well, maybe we were being a little too cute. I wouldn't be surprised if a judge suppressed his statement altogether.
Corinne reminded him of the footage from the hotel elevator.
He said, what did I do? It's basically a confession.
You don't understand how Olivia Randall operates. It's scorched earth. She'll hire experts to say the lip reading isn't scientifically reliable, and if she loses that, she'll get a linguistics professor to testify he said something else. Every single piece of evidence will be a battle. But even if the evidence comes in, she'll say he was so anguished about having cheated on his beloved wife that he was racked with guilt when he left her room.
He recreated the moment, placing his hands on his head.
What did I do? And my boss has made it damn clear that I have to win this case.
Well, I think I have something that potentially helps.
When she first ran Powell for Pryor's, the only entries she found were an incident when Powell witnessed a domestic violence assault in Washington Square Park and a report from a fender bender. After Carrie came forward, Corinne ordered copies of the reports to make sure she wasn't missing anything. The assault incident was from 8 years ago, and if anything, made Powell seem like a hero. He saw a man push his girlfriend to the ground and continued to try to grab her arm as the two of them walked away together. He followed the couple, asking the woman if she needed help. The man took a swing at Powell, who responded by punching the man in the face and breaking his nose. A bystander called 911, making it clear that Powell had acted in self-defense. At first glance, the report from the car accident, 5 years later, was a snoozer. A taxi pulled away with a fare and sideswiped Powell's Subaru in full view of a patrol officer. According to the report, Powell planned to seek repair of his car through his own insurance and did not want the incident reported. Corinne suspected that the taxi driver had mouthed off to the officer because he had insisted on writing up the accident and forwarding the report to the city's taxi and limousine commission. It was the kind of thing that happened hundreds of times a month in this city. Except that on that specific day, Jason Powell had a passenger in his car, a 24-year-old white female named Lana Sullivan. So curiosity kicked in again, and Corinne ran Lana Sullivan for hits. 3 years ago, if the patrol officer had run her for warrants, it would have come up empty-handed. But that was 3 years ago.
Way too much information, King said. Get to the punchline. Who's Lana Sullivan?
2 prostitution convictions since she took that little car ride with Powell, plus an outstanding warrant, at least as of this morning, for an FTA from misdemeanor court 6 months ago.
You picked her up on the warrant?
Gave her a chance to clear it and get a new arraignment ticket if she had a chat with me. She failed to appear for that one, too, but that wasn't Corinne's problem. She confirmed that Powell was her John that night.
You know how many dicks she's seen since then? She was telling you what you wanted to hear.
Corinne was shaking her head. She'd never been arrested at that point. A cop made her show ID. She was scared, so the incident was clear in her mind. She said Powell spent more time making excuses for employing her services than actually using them. He was talking about how the wife didn't let him touch her anymore, but he loved her too much to leave. King looked unimpressed.
His entire defense is that he's a married man who sleeps around on his wife. Proving that he went to a hooker 3 years ago doesn't really change anything.
No, but it might make a difference to the wife. Right now, she probably believes him.
If she starts to see another side of him, the side that bitches about her to random hookers,
maybe she's got something to say to us.
New York's version of the spousal privilege was narrow compared to other states. The government could force a spouse to take the stand, and only private communications between spouses were protected, not other forms of evidence, such as observations through sight or smell. In short, there was a lot of wiggle room as long as they could convince Angela Powell to cooperate.
All right, you're not pissing me off after all, King said.
That was good work.
Corinne wondered if she should tell King what she knew about the wife's background, but wasn't sure she could trust him. He was under pressure to win. She could imagine him threatening to use the information at trial to get her to testify against her husband. For Corinne, using her husband's infidelity as a chip was fair game. Using Angela's own victimization was crossing the line.
You still look miserable, Corinne said. Do you ever not look miserable?
He faked a large, cheesy smile.
I'm ecstatic. Honestly, what's your read on Carrie? Corinne shrugged.
You want the real answer?
No, I asked you a question, said you'd make up a bunch of bullshit.
You know how it is, and the stories never line up. No one's version is ever 100% accurate. The hard part is figuring out which parts are wrong, and more importantly, why they're wrong. Bad guys out and out lie because they're trying to protect their asses. The victims? That's trickier. Some of them almost apologize for the bad guys as they're reporting the facts because they're full of guilt, blaming themselves. Or they mitigate the awfulness of what happened to them because the full weight of it would kill them if they stopped to absorb it. Or they said they didn't drink or didn't flirt or didn't unhook their own bra because they're afraid that to admit the truth would be giving him permission for everything that happened after. You should give lessons on this stuff, Duncan. That was heavy. So what about Carrie? Which camp is she in?
I assume you have a reason for asking. What's scaring you about her?
King paused to throw the takeout container in the garbage can beneath his desk.
I think Olivia Randall got under my skin. This trial's gonna be a cluster.
Randall says Carrie's lying because Powell was about to expose her company for falsifying some kind of financial records to cover up kickbacks to bad guys in where the fuck is Stan. The whole thing made my head hurt.
Did Carrie mention any of this to you?
Corinne shook her head.
No, but there's something else. It could be related, I guess. An affair with the CEO.
You knew that?
I didn't think it was either material or exculpatory.
Those were the magic buzzwords for Brady material, the evidence that King would have been required to turn over to Powell's defense team.
Well, his attorney says it gives Carrie a motive under the circumstances to help the company malign Jason Powell. She was on the outs at work because of the affair. According to Powell, Carrie told him that the only reason she wasn't fired was because she threatened to sue them for discrimination. She was super paranoid about the company monitoring her emails and company cell phones, so that's supposedly why there were no texts or messages to back up his claim of a relationship with her.
Corinne reminded him that the absence of an affair would also explain the absence of romantic correspondence between them.
I know, but I've got to admit it makes me more than a little nervous that Powell knew she was cheating with the boss. If they were purely business, how would he know the details of an affair she had 3 years ago?
He had other contacts at the company. Carrie told me everyone at work knew, grist for the rumor mill.
Except Powell knew the wife's name. Mary Beth, by the way. He knows they have 3 kids, and then Mary Beth was so pissed off when she found the texts that she told their oldest daughter what Dad had been up to. And he claims to know that the daughter showed up at Carrie's house calling her a slut from the front yard. You think those are the kinds of details an outside consultant overhears at a meeting?
Sounds to me like bedtime chatter, swapping tales about the exes.
So let me talk to Carrie, Corinne said. See what her aversion is.
I already tried, and that's an even bigger problem. She got defensive, accusing me of blaming the victim. Man, she refused to talk to me at all about her company. She claimed it was proprietary business information and that sharing it could get her fired.
By the very company Powell claims she's colluding with.
Corinne could already picture Powell's defense in the courtroom.
Exactly.
King wasn't done listing his concerns about Carrie's motivations.
Oh, and don't let me forget this part. Did you know Carrie hired a lawyer?
She may need one if she thinks the company's looking to fire her.
Except she didn't hire an employment lawyer. She said she hired someone to protect her victim's rights.
He placed air quotes around the words with both hands.
She wouldn't give me the lawyer's name, but she definitely doesn't want to answer any hard questions, the kind she'll face on cross. And if Olivia Randall finds out our victim's hired a lawyer already, she's going to claim that the real motive for this case is money and a civil suit.
So, where does that leave us?
It leaves me with the case my boss wants me to take to trial. I tried telling him I have a bad feeling, but all he knows is that we've got a rich celebrity accused by 2 different women in a week. If we don't charge him, he'll be accused of favoritism. When I told him Olivia Randall was here trying to get the case dumped, he told me I could offer him 7 years.
7 years? You can kill someone in this city and get 7 years.
He's going to make me try the case, and Olivia Randall's going to make it feel like getting stabbed in the eye every single day for a month straight.
So, are we going to arrest him on a warrant or let him turn himself in?
Oh, there's no doubt he's getting a perp walk. I've got the affidavit for the arrest warrant ready to go, just like I promised the boss. You ready to pick this guy up? If we're lucky, you might bump into the wife and have a little chat with her about the hooker. She may be a total doormat, but no woman wants to know she's been swapping bodily fluids with a pro.
29.
I should have known that nothing good was going to come of my phone call to Olivia Randall when she began with her attempt at small talk.
So, Jason told me you drove Spencer to camp this morning?
I heard a pause mid-sentence and pictured her checking her notes to confirm my son's name. Yeah, up in Westchester, outside South Salem. Almost Connecticut, really. That's great that he gets to go to camp. Gives you a break, right? I was glad we weren't speaking in person so she couldn't see my glare. Jason said you wanted to speak with me? She thanked me for calling and explained again why she had kept me out of her meetings with Jason and Colin. I assured her it wasn't necessary to repeat the reasons. So my understanding is that Jason has told you that our defense is that the contact between him and the complainant was consensual.
Uh-huh.
Did he also tell you that he doesn't have any texts or emails to prove they had a relationship?
No.
He hadn't told me that, but it explained why I hadn't been able to find any, despite all my attempts. Obviously, it would be helpful if a third party could corroborate his version. If anyone could, it would have been Colin. He already told me that he suspected, but didn't really know anything. I wasn't talking about Colin. I was talking about you. Jason indicated that you may have been aware that there was someone else. You're asking me to lie for him. Just say it.
No, I'm explaining how you might be in a position to help, if you wanted to.
I understand that this isn't easy. To be clear, Jason has no idea I'm talking to you about this, and it has been a real challenge to get him to open up to me about your marriage, although I'm sure you can see how it will be relevant to this case. I closed my eyes. I could feel all of the doors ripping open around me, and there was no way I could pull them shut. Every new word she spoke made me feel dizzy. He says that intimacy, or physical intimacy at least, has not been a regular part of your marriage, and not at all for 3 years. Are you kidding me?
Please, hear me out. We have a good argument for consent, and all we really need is reasonable doubt.
But it's hard to paint Jason as the good guy when his defense is that he was leading a secret life, cheating on his wife. If that part of your relationship was over, if you knew, if even a part of you knew. Some couples have unspoken understandings. Maybe the two of you even had a good reason for separating that aspect of intimacy from your marriage.
She knew. She fucking knew.
It wasn't going to be enough for me to smile and stand by Jason's side and make sure the whole world knew that I believed he was innocent. She needed me to be the reason he cheated. I would be the screwed-up wife who was too frigid to keep a young, attractive man happy in the bedroom. He would seem heroic for loving me in the first place and then staying with me despite all my damage. I cut to the chase. You think the DA will back off if he knows I'm the girl who spent 3 years getting tortured by Charles Franklin? I'll be honest, Angela. This is not exactly my favorite part of the job. But yes, your background gives a different dimension to your marriage, and therefore to Jason's interactions with this woman. So I was right. Jason had told her about me. Unless, of course, Olivia had found out on her own, which seemed plausible. I didn't know about Carrie, I said, at least not specifically about her. And definitely not about a 3-month relationship. So 3 months is longer than you suspected?
Of course.
Why did she sound confused? Had it been longer? Jason told me it was 3 months. Okay, but you're saying that you did suspect outside encounters of some kind, but without, let's say, an emotional affair? Is that a fair representation? If this was what it felt like to have someone who was supposedly on our side question me, I could not imagine what it would be like to get cross-examined by the lawyer trying to put my husband behind bars.
I need to think about this. I don't want to talk anymore right now.
That's fine. I totally understand. But Angela, please remember, this woman is trying to destroy your husband, which means she's destroying your family. That's going to have consequences for both you and Spencer. At least this time she didn't hesitate on my son's name. Helping Jason helps the two of you, too. I heard Jason calling out my name from downstairs. Hold on, I yelled, breaking one of my own house rules. I'm talking to Olivia.
Angela!
Jason was screaming loud enough for people outside to hear. I asked Olivia to hold on and walk from the bedroom to the top of the stairs. I saw Jason being placed in handcuffs in the threshold of our open front door. For more than a week, I had been expecting this moment, imagining it about to turn the corner at any second. But Jason hadn't. His expression was panicked, and his eyes looked up at me, pleading. Olivia, they're here. I said into the phone. The police, they're arresting Jason. He didn't do this. Please, you have to help him.
Part 3. People versus Jason Powell. 30.
What does it mean to know something? I remember Mr. Gardner, my ninth grade teacher, asking us that question. He was widely regarded as the school's smartest, most challenging teacher, which meant that most of us had no idea what he was talking about most of the time. It was supposed to be a lesson about the importance of choosing words carefully. He began by asking us how many facts we thought we knew to a certainty. A long list grew on the chalkboard. The price of a Snickers bar in the vending machine, the name of our PE teacher, our birthdays. Then he said, okay, so what if I told you that the penalty for being wrong about one of these facts was having to spend the entire summer in school? Now, how many things do you know? We immediately second-guessed our so-called knowledge. Maybe prices were being changed at the machine as we spoke. Maybe Mrs. Calloway got married, changed her name, and never told the students. And maybe the hospital was wrong about whether we were born a little before midnight or a little after. And if the penalty for an error was losing a limb, Mr. Gardner asked. The lesson? We don't really know anything. Not really. To know something, he argued, was not the same as to be certain beyond all doubt. And to believe something was definitely not the same as to know it. With that as a backdrop, I'd say the first time I knew Jason cheated was almost exactly 2 years ago. We had taken a rental in the Hamptons for 6 full weeks. The cost of renting a small cottage half a mile from the ocean was twice what my mother made in a year. That was the bizarro economy of the South Fork these days. It was a splurge, but Jason assured me we could afford it. He had launched the consulting company and had extra money coming in on top of the book money we had sunk into the house. We only had one car, of course, the Subaru, before Jason decided we should get the Audi. But that wasn't a problem. Most days, the three of us were together. To the extent we needed supplementary transportation, the rental house came with bikes, and I could always call my mom in a pinch. That particular day, I had gone to Susanna's to help prepare for a dinner party. Jason said he had a meeting at a potential client's house in Bridgehampton, so Spencer tagged along with Mom on a house cleaning. I was riding my bike home from Susanna's when I thought I spotted our car parallel parked on Montauk Highway in the overflow parking area for Cyril's. It was post-beach cocktail hour, the time when people popped in for late-lunch lobster rolls, pre-dinner raw oysters, and a lot of frozen blender drinks. I was stopped on my bike, one foot on the gravel, one on a paused pedal, next to my own car, watching my husband talk to a woman I'd never seen before. He was drinking beer from a pint glass, looking exactly like himself, but the woman was more easily readable. She was flirting. She flipped her long hair a lot, licked her glossy lips, maintained good eye contact. She could have given instructions in a magazine. When I saw her touch Jason's knee, a part of me wanted to storm into the crowd, announce my presence, and ask Jason to introduce me to his friend. I didn't. I pedaled back to our rented cottage and waited for him to come home. When he finally arrived, almost 3 hours later, he immediately took a shower. I picked up his shirt, dropped so casually on the floor, and held it to my face. It smelled like the beach. That night, when he crawled into bed with me and held my hand, I fiddled with his ring. His tan line was faded. Was it proof enough that I was willing to spend the rest of the summer in school or lose a limb? No. But all the signs were there. We hadn't touched each other, not that way, for more than a year. More hours away from home, with vague explanations for his whereabouts, that girl at Cyril's. He'd clearly taken off his ring. At that point, I knew, to the extent that word has meaning. And yet I didn't say a thing. What Jason's attorney had called an unspoken understanding had been set into motion. At the time, that's not how I thought of it. Even as I leaned on the borrowed bicycle in the gravel parking lot, watching him flirt with a stranger, I almost felt closer to him. It was part of the bargain that was now our life together. We were supposed to have a normal marriage, but one half of the couple, me, wasn't normal. So neither were we. But I had lived with far more dangerous secrets. And so we went on. 31. Corinne immediately spotted two news vans when she pulled up in front of the special victims unit. A group of people clustered on either side of the walkway leading into the building.
Her original plan had been to fingerprint Powell at the 6th Precinct, less than a mile from his address, then transport him to Central Booking on Center Street. King disrupted that plan by instructing her to go to SVU instead. It wasn't the usual process, and it meant a round-trip drive to Harlem and back. Now that she counted at least 4 cameras, she realized King had given SVU as the location for the perp walk. She actually felt bad for Powell as she marched him, still in handcuffs, through the gauntlet. He had no way to hide his face. She could feel him jerking away from each flash of the camera. Once they were inside and she unlocked the cuffs, the only thing he said was, "I have a 13-year-old son." He stared straight ahead as she took his prints, followed by his mugshot. The press was gone by the time she walked him out, a mere 30 minutes later, having gotten what they came for. As she transported him to Central Booking, he remained silent. He didn't even ask to have the radio turned on, the way some people do, or ask where he was going next. His lawyer would have been pleased. Once she was done with the paperwork at Central Booking, her plan was to head back to Powell's place. The wife would be home, glued to her phone. The lawyer was probably busy trying to get a head start on cutting him loose. If Corinne was lucky, she'd catch the wife alone. She was 3 blocks away when she realized she wanted to know more about Angela Powell before knocking on her door. She pulled over and brought up the number she had saved for Detective Stephen Hendricks in East Hampton. "I just booked Jason Powell for rape." Hendricks spoke like an old, experienced cop, his tone completely unfazed. "So bad was it?" These days, you weren't supposed to distinguish. Rape was rape. The victim had him up to her hotel room after dinner, but there's evidence of injury, and he denied all contact with her, and we have DNA. Corinne believed you had to share some amount of information with other cops if you expected their cooperation. She was giving Hendricks enough to know that there were shades of a date rape dynamic to the case, but more than a complete he said, she said. "He's arguing consent?" "Basically," she confirmed. "Is there any way to keep the wife out of it? Angela's had a rough time of it, and this guy was supposed to be her happily ever after." "My impression is that she's managed to keep her identity fairly private. She didn't tell Hendricks that she never would have known who Angela was had it not been for his phone number in her call records." "Her parents made sure of it. I went with them to Niagara Falls when they got the phone call. I was the last person they wanted to deal with at the time, but they at least knew me. Angela was practically catatonic. They couldn't get her to hand the baby to anyone until she saw her mother." "You didn't have a good relationship with the family?" "The shorter version is, I could have tried harder. I thought she was a runaway."
"And that's why you've been trying to help her now?"
"Pretty much."
"So how can I help her?"
"Convince her to jump off a sinking ship. The DA is determined to get a conviction. She could leave now, take half his money, and find a new happily ever after."
"I'd be the last person able to convince her."
"So who has her ear?"
"Her best friend is Susanna Coleman, but,
I'm not going through a journalist."
"Of course not. Which is why I was gonna say the person she'd really listen to is her mother, Ginny. Her dad, Danny, died a few years back, but Ginny was always the one who looked out for Angela. I thought she was gonna clock the doctor who wanted to examine Angela and the baby after they were rescued. The way she saw it, Franklin and the other kidnapping victim were dead. If the police wanted to keep investigating, that was their business, but she took her daughter and grandson home and told the Pittsburgh police to pound sand."
"Where'd the other girl come from?"
"Franklin picked her up in Cleveland. That sicko made the girls use fake names. I think Angela was called Michelle. She called the other girl Sarah. They didn't find the body for 2 weeks and never identified her last I heard."
Corinne realized that part of her had been hoping Hendricks would be close enough to the family to persuade Angela to start looking out for herself instead of her husband. It was still worth a try.
"The husband will be arraigned tomorrow. I'm about to approach the wife now to see what she knows. What if you gave her a call first?"
"I think she'd hang up and take it out on you for having any association with me." "Wow, she dislikes you that much?"
He paused on the other end of the line. "The only time that family let me do one thing for them was to help them get a birth certificate for Spencer, that's the son. I found a doctor willing to look at the police reports and say it was a home birth in Albany, father unknown, so Franklin's name wouldn't be anywhere near the baby's. They did thank me, but it wasn't enough to earn their forgiveness."
Corinne wondered which cases would continue to haunt her years from now. She considered telling Hendricks not to kick himself, that every cop inevitably makes a wrong call, but she had no idea whether Hendricks was a good cop. Maybe he deserved to be blamed for what Angela went through. She thanked him again for the information and started the car engine. He offered her one more piece of advice.
If I had to guess, she's in denial. She built an entirely new life for herself and probably wants to think it's all going to be okay. If it starts looking dire, go to the mom, Jenny Mullen. Angela may think she's part of some other world now, but when push comes to shove, she trusts her mother more than anyone.
8 minutes later, Corinne stood at Angela Powell's door. 32. I checked my phone again for updates. Nothing. Have you heard anything? I sent the text to Colin and watched the ellipses on the screen as he typed his response. How could a text message take so long?
They transported him to SVU in Harlem instead of the 6th Precinct. By the time Olivia got there, they were taking him back downtown for processing.
So what does that mean? I hit enter.
Dots, followed by that he won't get in front of a court until tomorrow. Sorry, at a client dinner, can't leave. We'll call you ASAP.
So sorry, eh? Hang in there. 2 hours later, I was still alone. The house was so quiet. I was starting to regret turning down my mother's offer to come into the city for the night. I didn't want her to hear about Jason's arrest on the news, the way she'd heard everything else so far, but I should have known it wouldn't be a quick phone call. Of course, she immediately asked about Spencer, so I had to tell her that I had sent him to camp, which led to an argument about why I hadn't sent him to her instead, or at least tell her that her grandchild was going to be gone for weeks. Now I would have happily continued that conversation, simply to have another person in the room with me. I jerked when I heard a dull thump at the door. That hideous knocker was gone, so whoever was on our porch was intent on letting me know they were here. I walked gingerly to the front door so I could check the peephole in silence. I recognized the woman standing there as the detective who had read Jason his rights while a uniformed officer had placed him in handcuffs. "Call our lawyer," I yelled through the door. "You really want to talk about this through your door? There's people walking by on the street." I unlocked the bolts and opened the door. If I had met this woman in a different context, my immediate reaction to her might have been a positive one. She had a heart-shaped face that seemed to rest in a natural smile. She had dark brown freckles, and her only makeup was a little blush and some pink lip gloss. She stood with her feet a comfortable distance apart, making no effort to hide the extra pounds straining against the buttons of the crisp blue shirt beneath her blazer. But tonight, she was the woman who had arrested my husband and then made sure to drag him around the city long enough that he couldn't make it home for the night. In her left hand was some kind of document. "I don't have anything to say to you," I said, "and I'd appreciate it if you didn't yell implied threats for my neighbors to hear. If you're here with papers, you should go through Olivia Randall." She held up her free hand. "I know you've got no reason to trust me, but I'm actually here to help you, Angela. I'm Corinne. Corinne Duncan." She extended the same hand for a shake, but I didn't accept it. "I never told you to call me by my first name. Mrs. Powell. It's Powell now, right? Not Mullen?" I felt my knees give way beneath me. The detective moved backward until she was one step down on our stoop. "The last thing I want is for you to be collateral damage because of something your husband's done. He didn't do anything. In the nearly 12 years since I came home, not a day had passed that I hadn't feared exposure. But I realize now that my worries had faded over time. Now they were raging in a way I hadn't felt since I first ventured outside my parents' house after going back to Springs." "Obviously, there's another side to that story," the detective said. "The district attorney's office agreed to charges. The judge signed an arrest warrant. Your husband looked me straight in the eye and told me he never touched the complainant in this case, and yet we have DNA evidence proving otherwise. I'm assuming he lied to you, too." "I have spousal privilege," I said. "I don't have to talk to you." "So you have a lawyer?" "I told you before, Olivia Randall. I'm going to call her right now," I said, turning to retrieve my phone from the coffee table in the living room. "She's your husband's lawyer, Mrs. Powell, not yours. And she'll do anything to win a case, including use you and anyone else in a position to help her hurt her client. I don't know what Randall told you, but the DA can subpoena you. A few of your private conversations might be protected, but other matters are fair game. What time did he come home?"